Yeah?
Okay. So I'm going to start off, and I'm going to tag team with Deanne, and I'm going to provide sort of an overview of the floodplain issues that we've identified. And part of the reason I'm here is because NWF filed a lawsuit against FEMA on the National Flood Insurance Program. And the reason Deanne is here is because she wrote the biological opinion that was a result of that lawsuit. And so I'm going to provide sort of the policy and overview, and Deanne will focus a lot more on the science to give you a sense of what's going on with floodplains now, especially in Puget Sound, because what's going on with floodplains here could have huge implications nationally. So the first question you might ask is, why does National Wildlife Federation care about floodplains? And I think of floodplains a little bit like wetlands in the sense that they're largely misunderstood or not understood well. And for many years they've been developed, and certainly in the case of floodplains, they're still being developed. But they provide a lot of important benefits. And when things go wrong, you get things like this. And this gives you a sense of why we care about floodplains when you see a salmon trying to cross the road in a storm. To give you a better understanding of why we're here, I'm going to give you a quick commercial on the National Wildlife Federation. Like most conservation organizations, our mission is to protect wildlife for the future. What you may not know is that we're the largest membership conservation organization in the United States, more than 4 million members. We were started by hunters and anglers, gardeners and outdoor enthusiasts, and we really run the gamut in terms of Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberals, and urban and rural, which is different than most other conservation organizations, which focus their support primarily in the urban areas. Also, unlike a lot of organizations that focus on one area like grassroots organizing or science, we do pretty much all of that. We do the science, the policy, the education, litigation, and grassroots mobilization. So a few years ago, we were looking around and we were saying, okay, we've got to think again about how we protect and you know, what we ought to be doing to protect wildlife. And we looked at the effects that climate change were having, and we realized that climate change is really the most significant issue that is facing wildlife and habitats. And if we don't deal with that, all the rest of the conservation work we've done over the last decades will be lost. And so we developed three primary drivers, and you'll notice that the first two are climate-related. So confronting global warming, which is really about mitigation, that's passing the cap-and-trade bill in Congress, and we tried to do that also in Washington State. The second one is safeguarding wildlife from the effects of climate change, and that's really about adaptation, if you've heard about that. And so it's really about helping fish and wildlife adapt to new conditions. And then the third driver, which we've always had, is connecting people with nature, so getting people outdoors and giving them a sense that they're connected to this and that will provide for future generations to really connect to nature and also continue to protect it. So coming back to the first question, why does NWF care about habitat and floodplains? And that's because floodplains are, in fact, habitat. And what this slide shows is a list of actually lawsuits in locations around the country that are very similar to the one that was in Puget Sound. And the first one, Puget Sound, focused on salmon, steelhead, and orca. And those are endangered species that are affected by floodplain development. Same with Florida, the key deer, that was actually the first lawsuit that NWF filed. In Oregon, we filed a similar lawsuit around salmon. And it goes on. Sea turtles, Delta smelt in California. We've got birds. A wide variety of fish and wildlife are dependent on floodplains and riparian areas. And so these lawsuits now have really exploded over the country. The other reason that we're involved in this is because of climate change. And you've probably seen slides like this many times. Let's see if I can get this. There we go. So this is a slide of temperatures over the last 100 or so years. The middle line is the average over the course of the last 100 years, and you can see where it was colder than the average, and where in recent years it's been much warmer. And you can see the CO2 concentrations are tracking that almost identically, which is why we're really focused on reducing CO2 emissions. So temperatures have already risen 1.5 degrees, and given our future projections, they're likely to rise another 2 to 11 degrees, depending on how much CO2 continues to be released. And the way things are going, it's likely to be on the high side. So that has huge implications. Now, in terms of climate impacts on fish and wildlife, there are two ways that gets dealt. And one is that it exacerbates existing stressors. And so things like habitat degradation, fragmentation, loss, those things just become more significant because of the stress that climate change is adding to them. But in addition to that, it adds new stressors. And for each species, it could be a little bit different. But increased temperatures, floods and scouring, less water in the summertime, invasive species. And the IPCC report noted that as things are going, about 20 to 30% of species are likely to be at risk of extinction in the next 50 years. And so this is really significant for us, but for, I think, for everybody. Floodplains are also important because they are migration corridors. And as climate change is pushing species northward and upward, and it's eroding the southern extent of most of the species ranges, this provides a corridor route, a sort of a migration route, for moving to those new habitat areas, or the remaining habitat areas. For salmon, it also provides a critical link to what tends to be the best habitat, which is up in the higher elevations and the more undeveloped areas. And so the key thing is keeping the links, which is oftentimes the floodplains and the rivers, the quality there should be kept good, which means largely about water quality and also temperature. And a lot of streams have already reached the temperature threshold in which they can be lethal to salmon. And so restoring those areas and ensuring that they maintain their ability to transport salmon towards the better habitat is essential. Now, in addition to migration corridors and habitat, climate change is also going to have some effects on flooding. And you may have seen Cliff Mass here last quarter, I guess, and he made the statement that climate change is not showing a signal in terms of precipitation here. But across the country, it certainly is. And what this shows is that the heaviest 5% of storms, those that are most likely to lead to flooding, are actually increasing quite markedly. And this shows what it's been doing up until about 2005 or so. And these are the projections going forward in terms of the largest storms. And what happens here is that warmer air tends to hold more moisture. So when precipitation occurs, it tends to be heavier and sometimes more frequent as well, depending on the location. Now, that has implications for flooding. And what you can see here is that flood damage, this is in adjusted dollars, from 1906 to 2006, you can see a steady increase, especially the largest ones, and this is national. But you can see that is having some impact. And for Washington State, although Cliff Mass was saying that there isn't really a signal, the CIG report, the Climate Impacts Group report from last year, did make the statement that flood frequency will increase from January to March, especially in the transition zones. And those are primarily in Puget Sound, Southwest Washington, and the lower elevations of the Cascades, which is where the flooding is already tends to be occurring. So we're just going to likely see more of that, and it's going to increase over time. I'm not going to touch on this too much, but this is a slide. There's another piece to the whole climate change issue and floodplains, which is the coastal aspect and sea level rise. And this is a graphic from the California Climate Adaptation Strategy that shows San Francisco Airport under two scenarios. The light blue is 16 inches of sea level rise. And you can see that San Francisco Airport is largely underwater. And that's likely to occur by the mid-century, so about 40 years from now. The dark blue is 55 inches of sea level rise, and that's basically the rest of it plus. And that's what's projected to occur by the end of this century, in just 90 years. So, significant issue. So in terms of why we're here, so part of this is because we want to protect floodplains, and part of the reason that we've gotten involved is because of the National Flood Insurance Program. And so I'm going to give you a quick overview of that. Now, this is a program that most people have very little knowledge of, unless you have to buy insurance because your house or building is located in a floodplain. But it, in fact, has significant influence in development, land use policy, and development in riparian areas. It was set up in 1969 by Congress, and its purpose was essentially to make flood insurance available at affordable rates on a national basis. And it certainly does that. What it was also supposed to do was reduce federal expenditures for disaster assistance and for flood control. And it was supposed to guide development away from flood hazard areas. And if it had done that, we probably wouldn't be here. We'd be really happy. Unfortunately, what it ends up doing is something very different. The way it actually works is that communities choose to participate in the flood insurance program, and in order to qualify for it, they get better rates if they do participate. They get lower flood insurance rates, but they're supposed to enact flood control measures like guiding development away from floodplains and providing sound floodplain management and land use controls. And FEMA sets up minimum criteria for how you qualify for that. Unfortunately, what's actually occurred is that this has led to rampant development in floodplains and the federal government subsidizing development in those floodplains by providing below-cost insurance. And the result has been massive development in coast and floodplains and increased flood damage, which is costing everybody a lot of money. And currently, the National Flood Insurance Program is more than $19 billion in debt as a result. So to give you a sense how that plays out here in Washington State, since 1990, we've had 13 flood disasters. And that's basically one every other year. Just last year, 23 rivers flooded, four of them to record levels, which gives you a sense that we're hitting peaks and more peaks over time. You might recall that for the last 2 years, I-5 has been closed. It's actually closed four times over the last, since 1990. And we've totaled up an estimate of about $860 million in flood damage. I expect when we get all the data in, it'll be more than $1 billion in flood damage over the last 20 years. And this is all in a county. In King County is a CRS, or Community Rating Service, Rating System, Class 2, which is part of FEMA's thing that says if you enact more and more stringent regulations, you get better rates. And King County actually is the best county in the country in terms of its flood control measures. And yet it still is seeing these kinds of floods. Now, I'll give you a sense of what that means graphically. This is a map of King County, and note the square there. We're going to fly into that, and we're going to show you in red, between 1978 and 2006, in red is the area floodplain that used to be there and is no longer there. And that's, you can see that over here and over here. We're going to fly into this box right here to give you a sense of what that looks like. It's not even the worst place, but what you can see is that in blue here, actually in blue and red, was the floodplain that used to be there. In red is a place that is no longer floodplain, probably because of levees or something that has prevented the floodplain over here. This is now a golf course. But over here you can see this also is all houses. This is what used to be considered floodplain. This is still considered floodplain. And you can see that there's a lot of buildings in those areas. And that's what FEMA has allowed through their flood insurance policies. Another example is the White River. 1931, in blue shaded is the floodplain. You can see what it looked like there, what it looked like in 1995, not much change, a little bit here. And then between 1995 and 2009, this is the same shot, but now all of these buildings have been built in the floodplain. And this is the river right here. One last picture gives you a sense of this. the thicker the rivers, the more floods. So the thickest rivers here have had four floods since 2003. And in red shows you the counties that have had more than $10 million in flood damage. Snohomish is 16, King County 24, Lewis County 23. So it gives you a sense of where the floods are occurring and how much damage is occurring. These are still draft maps, and we're still doing more analysis on this. We're trying to get the USGS rain gauge data and flood gauge data so we can plot that on there and see how much above flood stage these rivers flooded. And so we're going to be doing a little bit more analysis before we release these. But I wanted to note, even with all this policy talk, there's a real human toll to this, and we shouldn't forget that. This is I-5 last year, underwater in Chehalis. This is in Snohomish County, farm area. This is a community in Puyallup, I think. You can see the damage, a couple of dogs that were rescued. And so there's a real human toll that occurs from all this flooding and these policies that lead to that. So that brings us to reforming the National Flood Insurance Program, which is what I've been working on quite a bit for the last year. And we're not the only one that's saying that there's been problems with the National Flood Insurance Program. There's been decades of complaints that it encourages development of flood-prone areas, that the subsidies are fueling harmful development. And the key thing here is that this is a voluntary program, and if you could remove the insurance availability for developing in floodplains, you'd essentially stop development in floodplains. And which would be a good thing not just for the environment, but also for public safety and for reduced taxes and reduced costs and just for sustainable living in our area. So this gives you a sense. These are a number of evaluations that have occurred. They've all basically said the same thing. The flood insurance program, as I've said, provides risky development in areas. The maps are not accurate. Repetitive losses, which are houses that have actually been flooded out more than two or more times in 10 years, and these are continuing to outpace mitigation efforts by 10 to 1. And this is the most critical one, I think. 20% of repetitive losses, so houses that have been flooded more than twice in 2 years, are outside of the flood, of what's mapped as floodplains, which gives you a sense that the floodplain maps are not accurate. So this gives you a sense here of where the repetitive losses are, and a lot of them are on the East Coast here. But here in Washington State, the Puget Sound, you can see it's pretty dark up there too. So this brings us to the lawsuit. The first one was in 1994 that we filed against FEMA in Florida for the key deer. And because FEMA and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did not actually behave appropriately and address the ESA concerns, the judge actually established a moratorium on development. So they actually stopped development in floodplains until they figured this out. That's still going on. And in 2004, we filed a similar lawsuit here in Puget Sound, and FEMA actually agreed, we got a positive ruling from the judge, and so biological opinion was made, which Deanne will talk about. So now we're trying to make sure that biological opinion is implemented appropriately. And our basic claim on this, for anybody who's interested from the law point of view, the Endangered Species Act, Section 7, says federal agencies must ensure that their actions do not jeopardize listed species or adversely modify critical habitat. And if they do, if their discretionary actions might cause harm, then they're obligated to consult with either the Fish and Wildlife Service or National Marine Fisheries Service. And FEMA basically said, no, we don't have to do this. We don't have to consult. Our actions don't harm. But the court said otherwise. And they said that FEMA has discretion over both floodplain mapping the minimum floodplain criteria and the community rating system. And so FEMA had to consult. And so that's how we ended up here. The result is, and I'm just going to hit on this briefly, Deanne's going to go into more detail, is that the biological opinion showed that the National Flood Insurance Program jeopardizes the existence of three salmon populations, the Chinook, Steelhead, and Hood Canal Summer Run chum salmon, as well as the southern resident killer whale population, primarily because the Chinook are its primary food source. And the BIOP then listed out seven what's called reasonable and prudent alternative elements. There's one RPA and seven elements to it. And the two that I just want to highlight, again, Deanna's going to go into more detail on this, but basically updating the floodplain maps because they're not accurate, and modifying the floodplain management criteria, which is essentially the minimum criteria that qualifies communities for participation in the program. And one of the key things I think the biological opinion did that was really brilliant was to say, don't just look at the past, but because of climate change, look at the future as well. Consider future conditions of development as well as climate change. And that's critical because if we're going to understand how what kind of flooding is likely to occur in the future, we need to be looking at what kind of conditions are going to be there in the future as well. The other thing I'll say is that we're currently dealing with the floodplain management criteria, and it looks like there might be something of a battle on that brewing in the future, in the near future. So I'm running out of time here, and I want to be sure that Deanne has the time to talk. So I'll just note that we have there's a lot of momentum for national change of the National Flood Insurance Program, and we're very much involved in working with FEMA and the Obama administration to achieve that. And we also have a similar agenda as we go forward of changing the eligibility criteria, fixing the mapping, making sure that the insurance rates are actuarially sound so that we're not subsidizing development there. And then also something I haven't really mentioned is focusing on natural approaches, because in the past we've really focused on built systems, levees, dams, dikes, those sorts of things. And what we found is really natural systems allowing the floodplains to function more naturally, keeping development out of floodplains, is far more effective than trying to build our way out of it. And the nice thing that, and this is something that even FEMA acknowledges, is that protecting floodplain habitat is actually consistent with reducing flood risk. So really, we're all trying to achieve the same thing. Although I haven't focused at all on solutions, I will note that, as I mentioned, taking an ecosystem approach here, especially forestry practices turns out to be a significant issue. This is a picture of some Weyerhaeuser cuts near Chehalis that right after a storm led to, essentially, I think what people are saying is this is one of the major causes of the I-5 flooding, is that when you do a lot of clear cutting in areas that are inappropriate, the stormwater essentially sheets down and is not held by the vegetation. So maintaining vegetation is critical to slowing the water and not having it funnel directly into the streams and then flooding. Low-impact development is also a critical feature in terms of maintaining the pre-development hydrology and even perhaps improving it. And then setting back levees so that, especially, for example, in the Green River, which you've probably heard about because of the Howard Hanson Dam, which has been highly at risk, the levees are right up against the river, and if you can push those back, then you've got a lot more room to accommodate floodwaters or stormwaters. So just to recap, floodplains are critical habitat, and they're an essential part of an adaptation strategy for protecting fish and wildlife. And protecting floodplains is good for not only habitat, but also for public safety. And it's better, I think, to use natural systems rather than built systems. I'm going to turn it over to Deanne now, and she's going to tell us a little bit more about the biological opinion and how that was reached.
Okay, so as Dan mentioned, I'm going to talk about the biological opinion that we wrote as a result of the consultation that was required based on the lawsuit. And as Dan mentioned, federal agencies have a responsibility to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service or National Marine Fisheries Service if their actions are going to impact listed species. And that also includes a duty to avoid jeopardy to the species and adverse modification of critical habitat. And as Dan talked about the lawsuit, so I'll just go directly into the species that we decided to cover in the biological opinion were Puget Sound Chinook, Puget Sound Steelhead, Hood Canal Summer Chum, Lycosette Sockeye, and Southern Resident Killer Whales. And we looked at critical habitat for all those species except for steelhead. And when we do a consultation for a jeopardy analysis, we have a pretty standard way of looking at the effects. First, we look at the effects of the program. We look at the status of the species that's being considered and the status of the critical habitat. We add that, the baseline conditions to that, and then we also add the cumulative effects, which under the Endangered Species Act are defined as the future non-federal actions that are expected to occur in the action area. And then when we add those all up, we get either jeopardy to the species or no jeopardy and adverse modification of critical habitat or no adverse modification. So when we looked at the program description of the National Flood Insurance Program, we looked at their mapping element, the minimum criteria, their community rating system, levies, and then, of course, the associated development that occurs as a result. And this is an example of a flood insurance map. It shows the 100-year floodplains and the 500-year floodplains, and these maps were changed based on natural changes and also man-made changes, such as levees or fill in the floodplain, and they're supposed to be updated every 5 years. And it's really important that these maps are accurate because this is what can happen. This is an example in the Green River Valley where you can see that people did development in a certain way based on the pink areas, which were the old identified floodplains under the flood insurance program. And now that they're updating their maps, they have a new floodplain area, which is much larger. And if development's already occurred there, we've lost the habitat for fish, and we've also placed people at risk for flood damages. The second element of their program that we looked at is the minimum floodplain management criteria. This is the criteria that FEMA sets that determines where and how development can occur in the floodplain. And this is an example on the Yakima River. You can see the floodplain in the green and the floodway in the red, and it shows that in this area, the developer has already identified where the various lots are going to occur, both in the floodplain and in the floodway, even though they're in an area where we have salmon listed under the Endangered Species Act, steelhead and bull trout. The third element we looked at in their program was a community rating system that provides reduced insurance premiums if communities exceed their minimum criteria. It also gives points for flood protection and flood reduction activities. And some of these activities are good for listed fish and some are not so good. The fourth element we looked at were levees. Levees can be included in the program if they provide the boundary of the 100-year floodplain. In other words, they're providing protection from that 100-year flood. And unfortunately, with a lot of levees, in order to get certified, FEMA uses the Corps of Engineers to do the certification, and then the Corps of Engineers applies their own criteria for certification, which means that all or most of the vegetation needs to be removed from the levees. So you end up having river corridors that don't have any vegetation on them, which, of course, are not very good for fish. And then the last component that we looked at of their program was the development that occurs in the floodplain. And as Dan's slide showed also, this makes it especially problematic for fish during flood events. You could see behind this truck, fish is trying to make its way across the road and try to find its way back to the river channel. So this is what happens when you have development in the floodplain or levees. It confines the channel, and there's no place for those floodwaters to go. So in general, when we looked at all those components combined, we saw that nowhere in their program was there a requirement to consider effects to ESA species or habitat. We found that their floodplain models and their maps were often inaccurate or out of date. That the program allows fill and levees and development, and all of these activities confine channels. Levee management also removes riparian vegetation and armors banks, and the increased stormwater from the development contributes to increased stream flows and decreases water quality. In terms of effects to critical habitat, the program leads to decreased flood storage and conveyance, decreased water quality, decreased recharge to groundwater so that fish don't have adequate flow in the streams during the summer, decreased riparian vegetation either due to development or levees, decreased soil fertility because the floodwaters can't get out on the floodplain, and decreased habitat for fish. Also leads to increased flood velocities, elevation flows, and volumes because of the confinement of the channel and the lack of the riparian and floodplain habitat for the floodwaters to spread out on, and that contributes to erosion in the channel and also increased water temperatures. And again, there was no place in their program that provided protection for any habitat elements that are critical for salmon, including the floodplain, channel migration zone, the riparian vegetation, off-channel habitat, etc. We know that salmon and steelhead use floodplain and channel habitat for rearing, foraging, refuge, migration, and spawning, and that salmon that use floodplains have a higher growth and survival rate, whereas salmon that are confined only to channels have to expend more energy just to stay in place in the channel, and they have access to reduced food sources. And the channels that are confined by levees and floodplain fill displace salmon, and that reduces their productivity and survival. So the next thing that we look at is the status and baseline. That's the status of the species and critical habitat and their baseline conditions. And for salmon and steelhead, we found that their status was already threatened and they were at high risk in a lot of their population criteria, and that killer whales were in even worse condition. They already were listed as endangered and they were considered depleted because their numbers are so low. Then when we looked at their critical habitat for salmon and steelhead, we saw that wide areas of floodplain had already been damaged throughout the Puget Sound area, and a lot of river systems had been channelized. So there was a large loss of estuarine floodplain habitat also, and that means that the fish don't have access to those areas anymore. And for critical habitat for killer whales, that mainly is dependent on their prey resources that are available. And the Chinook population was already at very low levels, so they already had decreased prey resources. And then we add to that the cumulative effects, which are the future non-federal actions that are expected to occur in the action area. And so in this case, we could see that in the future in floodplains, we would expect to see decreased channel and floodplain function, and that would mean decreased storage and channel capacity. And we would have, because of the increased development in the floodplain, we would have increased stormwater runoff. And as well, we expected that there would be climate change that would be contributing to these effects, as Dan explained. So we would have increased flood frequency and severity and increased water temperatures, which can be hard for fish, and decreased spawning flows for fish. So when we do the Jeopardy analysis, we add all these things up, the effects of the action, the baseline and the status, and the cumulative effects. And for the listed salmon and steelhead species, we found that at an individual scale, we expected individual numbers of fish would decrease, decreasing their survival. At the population scale, the various populations of salmon and steelhead would be reduced in their productivity and abundance. And at the ESU scale, or throughout their range, we expected to see a decrease in their spatial structure and diversity. And adding those things up, we came to a jeopardy of the species. Similarly, when we looked at critical habitat for salmon and steelhead, we looked at the conservation value of the critical habitat at the site scale, at the watershed scale, and at the ESU scale. And adding that up, we came to an adverse modification of their critical habitat. And we did a similar jeopardy analysis for the southern resident killer whales and their critical habitat, adding up the effects of the action, the baseline and status, and the cumulative effects. And when we add to that the fact that we already had a jeopardy of the salmon species, particularly for Chinook salmon, which are an especially important prey species for southern resident killer whales, we expected that we would see a decrease in the prey base for the southern resident killer whales and a decrease in their survival that would result in jeopardy to the southern resident killer whales. And for their critical habitat, because we already had the jeopardy for the salmon prey and a decreased conservation value throughout their whole range, we would have adverse modification of the southern resident killer whale critical habitat. So when we come up with jeopardy and adverse modification in a biological opinion, we need to write a reasonable and prudent alternative. And as Dan mentioned, in this case, we wrote up an RPA that had seven elements to it. Notification, mapping, the minimum floodplain management criteria, the community rating system, levees and development. We had a mitigation component, and then we also had a monitoring and adaptive management component. So the first element was the notification element that was required to be done by FEMA within 1 month of receiving the biological opinion. They were to tell all their communities that participate in the flood insurance program, that's 102 communities in Puget Sound, that the way that the National Flood Insurance Program is currently operating, that it results in jeopardy and adverse modification, and take of listed species. Suggested that communities could put a temporary moratorium on development in the floodplain until they implemented updated minimum floodplain management criteria. And it said that if that communities could get ESA coverage for adopting revised minimum floodplain management criteria. The second element of the RPA dealt with mapping. That was to be done by March of 2009. It said that FEMA could only issue map changes if it showed that they could avoid effects to listed species. FEMA would prioritize their map updating process based on the presence of important salmon populations. FEMA would do modeling using on-the-ground data, unsteady state, and 2D models instead of just doing 1D models as they have in the past. That the map modeling would consider future conditions instead of just current conditions and cumulative effects, including climate change, and that communities would be responsible for identifying flood risk behind levees using future conditions and cumulative effects. The third element of the RPA dealt with the minimum floodplain management criteria. We gave the communities and FEMA until September of 2010 or September of 2011 to complete their revision to the minimum floodplain management criteria. And basically what we said in the floodplain management criteria was that there could be no development in the riparian buffer zone, or that communities had to demonstrate that no adverse effects to habitat would occur. And we defined the riparian buffer zone as including the FEMA floodway, the channel migration zone plus 50 feet, and the stream buffer depending on stream type. And stream type is identified by the State Department of Natural Resources, and the stream buffer widths are identified by the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife. He also said that in the remainder of the floodplain, that development would be prohibited, or that communities had to mitigate for all habitat, flood storage, and development effects. Also, under the minimum criteria, we specified that all floodplain development had to use low-impact development to deal with stormwater effects. And if, for existing buildings, if there was a greater than 10% expansion of those buildings, they had to mitigate for all effects. And this was a change from FEMA used to let buildings expand without any mitigation if up to 50% of their footprint. Also, under the third element of the minimum criteria, we said that in the interim, communities had to track and report all the floodplain issues, all the floodplain permits that they issued, and in NIMPS, we would have an opportunity to review those development permits, and that FEMA would be responsible for mitigating any unmitigated activities. And over the long term, FEMA would report to us all the mitigation that occurred, and if it's not effective, that FEMA would provide additional mitigation. Under RPA Element 4, the community rating system, they had until June of 2009 to complete this. Basically said that they needed to increase or award points for actions that were beneficial to salmon, such as levee setbacks or buying out floodplains. And that they needed to reduce points for things that were detrimental to salmon, like levees and closing conveyance channels. And it's said that they should encourage communities to have their levees certified by professional engineers rather than the Corps of Engineers so that vegetation can be maintained on levees. We addressed levees in development under RPA Element 5, and FEMA had until September of 2009 to complete this change. We specified that FEMA would recognize Corps-certified levees only if there were no adverse effects to listed species, that FEMA would revise their policy so that levee owners could still get emergency funding, even though they didn't have Corps certification of the levees. We also said that FEMA could only recognize levees in their program if they provided natural floodplain function, and also that FEMA would use some of their own funding to support floodplain acquisition and other actions that are beneficial to habitat. And the last part of the RPA, 6 and 7, dealt with mitigation and monitoring. We said that mitigation for NFIP actions that degrade habitat had to be provided, and also for any failed mitigation. And we gave FEMA a timeline for reporting progress to us, and we have an opportunity to review their progress and determine if alternate actions might be necessary. So that's it. I think... that's the end of my presentation. I think Dan and I are open for taking questions.
Time for a few questions at the end here. Thanks.
For those folks who have already been allowed to develop in floodplains, what about them? How do they get insurance, and how do they get affordable insurance? Is that the question?
Yeah.
And so the way Congress has dealt with that in the past is that they have provided lower rates for people who were there prior to 1969, and then supposedly raised the rates to be actuarially sound. It's likely that the rates would have to be adjusted, but they would probably be protected as well for those folks who are already there. Primarily, the focus for us, we recognize that development that is already there is likely to stay there in most cases. But what we're really trying to do is prevent additional development going in. And so it's really about stopping and providing good price signals for preventing future development going in. Except in the cases of those places that are repeatedly flooded out, those places should actually be bought out rather than rebuilt. And those people who own those properties should be given the resources to develop elsewhere, but only once. Because repeatedly developing in the same place and getting flooded multiple times benefits nobody.
Okay, one more question.
Many of your deadlines in kind of the modifications that you recommended were in 2009. So can you give us a little update on how FEMA has met those and if they have had any pushback that you guys have had to kind of sit down and work through?
I'll repeat the question.
Yeah, so the question was, a lot of the timelines have already passed, and so you're asking for an update on where we are in terms of have they met those timelines or not. So I think I'm thinking through them in order. So the first one, the notification, they met that, no problem. That was within a month. I think the second one was the mapping element, and they're we're still working with them on that. One of the big problems that we're running into is their ability or willingness to look at climate change when they do mapping. So that hasn't been resolved yet. The third element was the minimum criteria, and that's the one that has the first deadline there is this September. So we're not there yet, but we've been working with FEMA on that. They've been developing some guidance documents on how development can occur in the floodplain, and we've been checking their progress. The fourth element was a community rating system, and they've developed some guidance for that, but they haven't yet made all the changes that we suggested. And then there was the levies. They said that they're not going to be able to implement the levy changes that we recommended. And the sixth element was mitigation. They're going to have the communities do the mitigation instead of FEMA. And then, but we are, the seventh element was adaptive management. And so we are still working with them. We are looking at their progress over time.
Okay, so feel free to come up faster. So thanks very much.